It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The City of Pittsburgh and the Heinz Endowments are spearheading a major effort to forge a new model of urban growth and development that is innovative, inclusive, and sustainable. This model is based around a central unifying framework, P4, People, Planet, Place, and Performance. The International Summit taking place in Pittsburgh this week. Today is day two, and I'm joined by one of the speakers from day one of the summit, Amory Lovins, co-founder and chief scientist of the Rocky Mountain Institute. He's an energy advisor to major firms and governments in more than 60 countries, and he's currently co-leading a major effort for China's National Development and Reform Commission to explore a renewables trajectory. And he joins me here in the car that's taking him to the airport, to be quite honest with you. Amory Lovins, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me. I expect people can hear the authenticity of the car noise from time to time, but very happy to talk to you.
Tell us about the presentation that you made at the summit, focusing on renewable forms of energy and how they can apply to cities like Pittsburgh.
Well, it was about efficiency and renewables, how they're both moving very fast. They're both taking over the market very rapidly, just because they work better and cost less than the traditional alternatives, and how any place like Pittsburgh can apply them to great advantage. So I started by describing a business book summarizing a major study 61 of us at RMI did over six quarters to look at a cheaper, better U.S. energy system. It's called Reinventing Fire because, after all, a long time ago, fire made us human, then fossil fuels made us modern, but now we need a new fire that makes us safe, secure, healthy, and durable. It turns out that the United States could run a 2.6-fold bigger economy in 2050 using no oil, no coal, no nuclear energy, a third less natural gas, three times as efficient use, five times more renewables, and it would cost $5 trillion less than business as usual, not counting any hidden or external costs or benefits, but just the what it costs to do these things versus the cost of the energy you don't have to buy. Carbon emissions would go down about 85%. The air would get cleaner. National security would be greatly enhanced. I think the world would be more stable and safe. And it turns out this also requires no new inventions and no act of Congress, because the policies you need to do it can be done at a city or regional or state level. They don't have to be all in Washington. And the transition is basically led by business for profit. That's what the $5 trillion on the table helps to induce. The U.S. is already on this trajectory for the first 3 years of this 40-year journey, and we're actually a bit ahead of schedule on renewables.
Are we finding, or are you finding, that there's a willingness in the United States to do this after so many years of having a business model that relies on fossil fuels and from which so many people profit that they, in some cases, are reluctant to be proponents of change?
I just gave a talk in Oslo to 150 leaders of the world oil industry, which I've worked for 42 years. I'm a member of the National Petroleum Council. And I think they were rather shocked to learn of the fully laid out competitive landscape in which they're going to have to operate. And it's changing with very disruptive speed that poses a great challenge to leadership, to try to make the culture change faster. Because as Jack Welch said, if the rate of change on the outside is greater than the rate of change on the inside, the end is near. So I showed a couple of pictures from Tony Seba, who's an innovation lecturer at Stanford, looking down Fifth Avenue in the Easter Day Parade. In 1900, you have to look hard to see the first car. In 1913, you need to look even harder to find the last horse. And the horse and buggy operators thought they'd have forever to make this change. After all, we have all this infrastructure of stables and boober scoopers and Lord knows what. And, you know, you'd have to build all these new streets and traffic lights and gas stations, well, they forgot that the pace of change is set not by incumbents but by insurgents who are not encumbered by your infrastructure, your business model, your cultural hang-ups. They are not inhibited by any of your attitudes. They really don't need you. And what Henry Ford did was just cut the cost of a Model T. It went down nominally 62% in 13 years. Well, the cost of solar cells just went down 80% in 5 years. And that's a meteorite strike, you know, hitting the incumbent industries on the head. Because after all, you don't have as an incumbent as long as the insurgents grant you, because investors flee before customers do. At the first whiff of disruption, the capital markets decapitalize you. They pull their money out. If they think you're in the toaster or headed for the toaster, they don't wait for the toast to get done. They just take money out of your activity and put it into the new stuff. And this is already happening to the electricity and oil industries, partly for the obvious but little noticed reason that U.S. use of gasoline and electricity have both been going down since 2007. And I think it took probably 5 years for this to sink in the electricity industry, that declining demand is the new normal, and very rapidly growing renewable and distributed competitors are the new normal. In Europe, the 10 big utilities bet against that future, led by Germany, and they lost half their market value in 5 years. And now the biggest of them, E.ON, announced it's splitting in two. They're going to give the old fossil-fueled nuclear plants back to the shareholders in case they can figure out how to make money off it, because the management can't. The management will stay with the new company, which will offer efficiency, renewables, smart grid, various customer service offerings, and they think they can make money at that and provide better service at lower cost and make more money at less risk.
So as innovation advances, what are some of the cool new things that on the energy horizon that we have to look forward to?
Well, they're almost too numerous to count, like the stars in the sky, but let me give a few examples. Just the routine improvement in both wind and solar power have made them already cheaper than new gas power in almost all of the country, soon in all, if you properly count that the gas price is volatile, but the renewable price, like efficiency price, is constant. So you can buy 30 years worth of service at a constant price right now, and you can get it financed right now. You don't have to pay for it all at once. So in 20-odd states, entrepreneurs will happily put solar power on your roof with no money down and beat your utility bill. And Deutsche Bank says that'll apply in about 80% of the world 2 years from now, because we got 21st century technology and speed colliding head on with 20th and 19th century institutions, rules, and cultures. And it's the most disruptive place you could possibly be. All the comfortable assumptions are being turned upside down, most of all from the demand side, which people don't pay enough attention to. And the big surprise there is that we've learned how to design buildings, factories, and vehicles so that very big energy savings cost less than small or no savings. So when you invest in efficiency now, you can get expanding returns, not diminishing returns. I live, for example, in a passive solar banana farm way up in the Rockies near Aspen, where it used to go to minus 47 Fahrenheit sometimes, minus 40 about once a year. But we don't have a heating system. We didn't need one. And it saved construction cost not to put one in, because the stuff that got rid of it, the super windows and super insulation and so on, cost less to install than it would have cost to put in a heating system, let alone to run it. So my house is a net exporter of solar electricity. Now, this is the archetype for 30,000-odd European passive buildings that, like ours, need no heating system and have roughly normal construction cost. But we did that back in 1983. The technologies now are much better, so we put them in to see how much better they are. The trouble is the measuring equipment seems to use more electricity than the lights and appliances were measuring. And to give you an idea of how fast the state of the art is moving, when I led the retrofit design for the Empire State Building in 2010, we thought it was pretty decent that we came out saving 38% of the energy with a 3-year payback. But then 3 years later, some of my colleagues did a 70% saving, fixing up a equally or more difficult half-century-old federal office complex in Denver, faced the wrong way, a lot of problems, but still 70% saving on a retrofit, that is fixing up the existing building, still with a good business case. That made that old building more efficient than the most efficient new office in the country.
And so how's the Empire State Building doing after this retrofit? I imagine it could or could not be a somewhat daunting task to retrofit a building that is over 80 years old.
Yeah, it was built in the Depression in, I think, something like 13 months. It was really fast. Mm-hmm. Amazing achievement. But they were doing a roughly billion-dollar renovation anyway. The building was kind of run down and all chopped up into little teensy spaces. Now they have consolidated the tenancies. They've got much higher quality tenancies, higher rents, higher productivity and happiness of the people in the building, enormously greater real estate value and financial returns. How did we do the energy part that was added on to the rest of the renovation at a late stage? Well, we remanufactured all 6,514 windows in a temporary window factory set up on a vacant floor into super windows that are nearly perfect in letting in light but blocking heat, and they also insulate 4 times better. Then we insulated some uninsulated parts of the walls and put in better lights and air handling and controls and office equipment. And when you added all that up, on a hot afternoon, the building would now need a third less cooling than it used to.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Amory Lovins, co-founder and chief scientist of the Rocky Mountain Institute. He's in Pittsburgh. He did one of the presentations as part of the P4, People, Planet, Place, and Performance Summit, taking place in the city. And I mentioned at the outset that you are an energy advisor to major firms and governments in more than 60 countries, and that you're co-leading a major effort for China's National Development and Reform Commission to explore a renewables trajectory. Talk about what you're doing there and some of the similarities that you mentioned to me before we started recording between what China is facing and what Pittsburgh faced years ago.
Well, China is at least as heavily industrialized as Pittsburgh was when you had very dirty air. You had lots of coal, and you were burning it in dirty ways, and you got to the point where business couldn't recruit and retain a lot of talent they needed because the air was so bad. So after the war, Pittsburgh business leaders did a terrific job cleaning up. China is doing the same thing now for the same reasons and, of course, to boost their economic development because efficiency and renewables are now cheaper than conventional supply. And, of course, since China's coal burn actually went down last year as the economy grew 7.4%, they're well on the track of starting the kind of massive cleanup effort that has worked so well already for Pittsburgh, and you still have some more to do, but with the kind of local leadership that's emerging, I think you've got a very good shot at doing a kind of sister city deal, and I don't know whether formally, but achieving the same kinds of broad economic and social benefits along with environmental cleanup that China is aiming at. Many cities around the world have cleaned up. We used to have filthy air in many other American cities, although Pittsburgh was often the poster child for that. Mm-hmm. And we now have in America a lot more solar jobs than we have steel or coal jobs. And the solar jobs are growing 10 times faster than general employment.
The future does indeed look bright. We've been talking with Amory Lovins, co-founder and chief scientist of the Rocky Mountain Institute in Pittsburgh, taking part in the P4 Summit. Mr. Lovins, wish we had more time, but thank you for making time for us in your ride to the airport. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you and good luck.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. A local Garfield tattoo parlor is facing unexpected difficulties. A lax building inspector led them to believe that nearly $90,000 in updates and repairs were not immediately necessary. But now the shop must raise the money during a six-month grace period just to keep its doors open and to keep the space from turning back into a vacant storefront, as well as fight for Garfield's arts economy and the residents who are invested in it. The owners have less than 2 weeks left on their Keep Artisan Alive Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign, one of the top 10 of all time in Pittsburgh. I'm joined now in Studio A by Jason and Meliora Angst of Garfield's Artisan Tattoo. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
And if you have a comment or question, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh at wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. What was Artisan's beginning? What state was the building in when you first signed a lease to start your business there in Garfield?
Well, to be clear, we actually didn't sign a lease. We bought the building. So we do own it. And it was in a pretty rough straits.
No windows, walls, army of cats living in there, no electricity. I mean, we rebuilt it from the ground up.
Yeah, there were, you know, basic utilities running into the building, but it needed to be completely replumbed. It needed all new electric system.
New roof.
New roof.
It was a brick tent.
How long ago?
About four and a half, five years.
4 years.
4 years?
Four years next month.
So you bought the building outright?
No, not completely outright. We have a mortgage, yeah. You know. But it was, we bought the building and it was pretty rough. You know, we got it for a pretty good price. But, you know, they say if you want a $300,000 building, you either buy a $300,000 building or you buy a $50,000 building and you put $250,000 into it. So I kind of thought we would be able to get around some of that, but that's not the case. In fact, it's actually quite a bit worse.
So when you first started the business, how long did it take you from the time that you bought the building, fixed it up, and then opened up shop before, you know, you were able to start attracting customers and make money?
Well, so we're not just a tattoo shop. You know, the tattoo shop is what funds most of the rest of the things that we do. And we got that part up and running in about, 6 months?
Yeah, we bought the building late May 2011.
So we got the...
And then we opened... sorry to cut you
off.
Oh,
no, it's okay.
We opened late November 2011.
Yeah. So, and that was just the tattoo shop. And that tattoo shop, we got open as fast as possible to fund the rest of it. You know, we also have an art gallery that's part of the Unblurred Gallery Crawl in Garfield. We have a show every month. We're trying to have a cafe there as well. We have a small store that showcases things from local artists. And so that's still been ongoing. And we, you know, so we got the one area up and running, and then we've been working on the rest ever since.
So you got everything up and running. You're building a business. You're attracting customers.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Well, I mean, our business has been very successful. I think the biggest roadblock before this issue is the Penn Avenue construction. We were in the middle of, you know, there was a really serious construction. Our road was completely tore up for about a year and a half.
Penn Avenue up in that
totally.
Area. It affected a lot of businesses.
It did, yeah. And so that affected us heavily. And then as soon as that took a break for the winter, we were hit with this. And we had a building inspector come in.
And this is explain. I gave sort of a summation of it. But
yeah.
Tell us what happened with the city and the inspection.
Basically, what had happened is that when we had first bought the building and we were first building, we were working with a building inspector that was very lax and kind of was just happy we were in Garfield and said, you know, just a couple examples. We had some bathrooms that were 2 inches too small. He was like, it's 2 inches. That is close enough. He signed off on that, you know. The fire escape, which is our main expense, he said we were able to, as long as we had the permit out and we were working on it, that we were able to, you know, get that done in time. We just couldn't open this cafe until then, you know, which is what we'd been doing. And then he is no longer with the city. He retired.
Right, and this sounds like this was part of Bill Peduto's effort to get people to move on from city employment if they were no longer invested in their jobs, which it seems on the face of it, at least, that this particular inspector was not. That,
right.
That this individual misled you or misguided
Correct.
You in terms of what he thought you could get away with not
right.
having to fix.
Yeah,
and he
in his defense, though, like yeah. it seems, though, that that was like just the status quo as far as building inspection
Back
goes
in the
day, city.
Yeah.
Right, which
up
is
until
the kind of thing
just,
that the city is trying
right.
to get away from now.
Yeah, yeah, it was just last year that it actually changed, and they used to have a very small amount of inspectors that would cover the whole city, and especially in a neighborhood like Garfield, they would come in and they'd be like, hey, you're doing something. You're trying.
And why did you select the Garfield neighborhood? So that, in other words, this inspector said, hey, this is great that you're trying to make
right.
a go of it here.
Yeah, exactly.
And why did you decide to do that in the first place?
Oh, I personally, I feel pretty connected to Garfield. I used to work in a metal shop there, just actually what was a building that is now just gone, actually, over the last month. But I worked there for a number of years, and it was pretty dear to me. And I made my return back to Pittsburgh in about, it was late 2003, early 2004. You know, I'm from the local area, and then I traveled for a number of years. And that would happen to be like sort of my rebirth into the city. I connected with the arts community that's there, that it, a lot of them even still there, actually. And it just, I really took a liking to it, you know. Ended up, I've always been like a sort of more of a South Side kind of guy, you know, or like a South Side boy, but, you know, we're talking like early 90s. And whenever I moved back, the East End was just, it just ended up being my home. And then we actually...
I mean, I met Jason, my husband, during an art show and an art crawl in the Garfield area, what once was...
Not even necessarily an art show, but actually the Unblurred event. I believe it was May in 2000 and...
It was like 12 years ago.
Three or two.
But you were very right about, you know, the mayor's office. I actually was contacted by someone from the mayor's office when this happened to us. And I just wanted to state that we're not angry at the city. The city has been unbelievably supportive. And when talking to some folks that worked at the mayor's office, there was, you know, verification that, you know, in fact, that did happen, that they were streamlining, you know, that office. They were trying to make it more usable. Businesses, you know, people that, because, you know, sometimes when people are, quote unquote, doing you a favor, they're really hurting you in the long run. And they were trying to do all that. And this guy had left, you know what I mean? And it had been actually about 6 months to a year where we fell through the cracks.
So this is where you think the miscommunication happened?
This is the miscommunication. So the first building inspector was really lax. You know, he doesn't work there anymore due to that, you know. And the new guy came in, but he wasn't assigned to our case because how it normally works is you pull out a permit, you do that work, you contact them, they come inspect it, and they sign off. Now, when he quit his job, we weren't finished yet. And we still are not finished because he led us to believe it could be years to work on this project at this level.
Yeah, we really thought we had an open timeline.
Yeah, we actually had a newspaper reporter.
Sorry.
We had a newspaper reporter that was doing a story on businesses that have been, you know, built from the ground up and done it themselves. And they came to us and we answered some questions and we thought we were legal and fine. We had a permit.
So this story comes out and the city says,
Yeah, the city says, well, the reporter was fact checking, you know,
yes.
to get codes right and things. And
yeah,
she called them. And
the
they said,
"You're is really what dealt us in, I guess.
What?
The due diligence of the
Well,
reporter.
No, it was – no. So anyway, so she called to do some fact-checking just, you know, on her story. And they looked into it and saw, oh, they have this building inspector on this permit that's still out that hasn't worked here in 6 months to a year. We need to send a new, you know, inspector to get them on this job. And they came out and the new guy said, I understand that this guy told you this was all okay, but it's certainly not. They gave us a six-month temporary occupancy because we had gone into that situation, which they didn't have to do. It's very nice of them. And they've been really working hard, you know, with us, walking us through every step down, you know, downtown and helping us out. But, it was a miscommunication. And
could you have been more proactive in terms of your communicating better from your end? And I ask that because For his part, city spokesman mm-hmm. Tim McNulty says the city issued a facade renovation permit to you in 2012.
Correct.
Then issued a permit for other renovations mm-hmm. in 2014. Mm-hmm. And after that, though, he was quoted in the Pittsburgh City paper as saying that you, Artisan, mm-hmm. did not contact the city to have the work approved so that your business could receive its occupancy permit. And here's the exact quote from Tim McNulty.
Sure.
He says, quote, "The city works with small businesses all the time, and after the initial permits were issued, basically we were waiting for them," meaning you, Artisan mm-hmm. Tattoo, "to come back and be inspected, and it just didn't happen," end quote. So
yeah,
ultimately,
that's exactly true.
So who ultimately has to take responsibility here?
Well, to answer that, the reason that we did not go to them to have the work inspected is because it is not finished yet. We have the blueprints drawn up. We have the foundation built for the fire escape. You know, we've been consistently building the entire time.
So you're thinking we have X amount of years.
We thought we had years because the original inspector told us that you could have a permit out as long as you were working on it for 2 years. And after that 2 year time, you just had to renew it if the work wasn't done.
Did anybody from the city say, no, you have to get back to us after a year or two and tell us how things are coming along?
No,
they did not. They said, when the work's done, you call us, you know. And so we hadn't called. And they'd actually had a couple inspectors pop in just randomly because we had a permit in our window. And they said everything looked fine, you know. But it wasn't the one on the case, you know. So when we got our new one assigned and he actually did like a thorough walk around, you know, and did everything, he said, hey, this isn't cool. That's not cool. You know, you need to do this. So the only reason we hadn't called for the inspection is because the work was not done yet and we were still working on it. And the reason it's taken so long is because we've been rebuilding a three-story building out of pocket. You know, we haven't been able to get a bunch of loans. We're just doing it with the money we generate in the tattoo shop. So it's a slow process. And we were absolutely going to call as soon as the work was done, you know. Now we just have to get it done really fast.
In 6 months.
Yeah, and it's a lot.
We're talking with Jason and Meliora Angst of Garfield's Artisan Tattoo.
Angst.
They... Angst. Oh, yeah. Okay, my. Yeah. You say tomato, I say tomato.
Exactly, it's totally fine.
What might be a cautionary tale about how they got a business up and running in Garfield, but they ran into some problems with renovations they were doing that they were required to do, but there was some miscommunication about the timetable and how they were to communicate with the city, and now the situation they find themselves in is they have $90,000 to raise. What was originally a 6 month time period, and I believe it's down to what, a couple weeks or
no?
Just with the artisan,
no.
Oh, excuse me, with the Indiegogo crowdfunding.
So actually,
how much time is left in that?
Actually, in the crowdfunding, 10 days.
10 days. Okay,
10 days to raise the money.
That's why I was thinking it's less than 2 weeks to raise that money. All right. So how much have you raised?
We have raised just over $35,000.
So you're just barely more than a third of the way there. So how do you get to 90,000?
We are at 40%.
40%.
Yeah, we just hit 40%.
So how do you get to 90,000, and when do you have to get to 90,000?
I mean, we have to get to 90,000 before the campaign closes. So we have 10 days. And how do we get there? We're not entirely sure. We're reaching out.
But okay, I'm just trying to understand this. Did the city give you more than they gave you 6 months?
Six months
starting from when?
Yeah, so I can explain that. So they actually gave us a 30-day cease and desist unless we got our bathroom that was 2 inches too small, tore down and rebuilt. And when that was done, they would issue us a 6 month temporary occupancy. Our inspection on that bathroom actually happened just this morning. They finally got somebody out to inspect it, and we were approved. And so the 6 month temporary occupancy starts today.
Yeah, it actually started while you were having your last interview.
Started about a half
an hour ago. Not much time.
Yeah.
let's go to the phones. We have someone who'd like to jump in and join the conversation. Wayne in the North Hills. Wayne, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Jason and Meliora Angst of Garfield's Artisan Tattoo.
Yeah, I've seen their ads looking for funding, so I'm a little bit familiar with it. I do a lot of work in the city of Pittsburgh for, you know, redoing buildings, rehabbing buildings with architects. And there's a misconception with a lot of developers that you can rely upon the city to help you do your design. And they just don't do that. They have no authority. They only look at drawings and see if they've been done according to the drawings. What you really need to do is get a good design professional, an architect in there. Everybody sounds like a lot of money at the start, but it saves you tons of time and tons of money in situations like this. Now, they may have used an architect. If they didn't.
We did.
No, we did, actually.
You did?
Two architects, actually.
They're saying they did, Wayne. They're saying they used an architect. Two, in fact.
We had our original architect.
The city is are the people that no, they didn't fail you. They just look at the drawings that the architect provided.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the architectural drawings are they're stamped, they're approved. The downtown likes them. It's just that we were under the assumption we had an open time frame to complete the work because we are completing the work out of pocket, and you can understand, you know, a $67,000 secondary egress is kind of that's a hard thing to just kind of come up with. So we were biting it off in little chunks, and those little chunks need to happen a little faster at this point, as you can understand.
Another thing to mention too about the architect is we did have originally our first architect. We had gotten, you know, we'd researched him. Someone said he was great. He did a bunch of drawings for us, charged us a bunch of money, and when we took them downtown. They didn't even believe an architect had drawn them, you know, and they had a stamp and everything. And we had to just pay to have them done again and start all over. And that actually, you know, complicated a lot of things downtown for us as well and took some extra time.
Wayne, yeah. Well, thank you for that phone call. We're getting somewhat short on time. So a couple of things I wanted to ask you about it. And one is, why not give this area up or this building up and go to a different location? Why put there's that cliche about throwing good money after bad, but it sounds like you still have a long way to go to get to where you need to be and that you still may not get there. And in the meantime, can you get the money back that you've invested?
Why not
go somewhere else?
Well, when you think
with
about
Wolf
it.
Garfield, I mean, we're really invested in the arts crawl there. I mean, we're really in, but we've got about 14 people that rely on this building.
Attractive about that community space?
Well, it's right in the middle of the Unblurred event that, you know, has really kind of created the arts landscape there in Garfield. And it actually is a really beautiful building. You know, it has some really great quirks about it, and it's, you know.
We have a 1,000-square-foot floor that I made out of pennies. I glued 250,000 pennies to that floor. I just don't want to have to go into a Walgreens with a penny floor one day and know that we failed. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
The money, if we can raise the money and throw it at this building, you know, money's never been the most important thing to us. I mean, we've invested a lot of our money, one of the reasons we're in this position, into our friends' businesses, you know, that we'll never see back. You know, I mean, the coffee shop that is starting there, the piercing shop that was on the third floor that was evacuated. You know, I mean, we just want to be in Garfield. We want this center to be in Garfield. We love Garfield, the arts community. We've been working heavily with the Bloomfield Garfield Corporation, who's been doing a lot over the last 20 years to.
Yeah, they've really pretty much adopted us into their world, which is really, you know, it's a beautiful and awesome thing.
The only reason we were able to get the building in the first place is because they co-signed on a loan for us to get the building initially. I mean, I want to see it through and make their investment in us be an investment in Garfield.
Yeah, and on top of that, I mean, 4 years of really intense toil would be really sad to lose.
Well, we wish you well and best of luck with this. Jason and Meliora Angst of Garfield's Artisan Tattoo, they're trying to keep it going and time is running out. So we wish you the best. We thank you for coming in and joining us on Essential Pittsburgh today.
Yeah, you can keepartisanalive.com.
And thank you. We really appreciate it.
You bet. Coming up, travel contributor Elaine LaBalme has recommendations for biking and hiking venues in the region. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. With the arrival of warmer temperatures, it's time to get outdoors and find time to stop and smell the wildflowers. Elaine LaBalme, who tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town, joins us this week with recommendations for biking and hiking in the great outdoors. Elaine LaBalme, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, I'm well, Paul. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good.
Okay, new girl, you've got spring fever and you're ready to hit the road to hike, bike, and smell the wildflowers. Tell us a bit about the Pennsylvania State Park System.
Well, what I can say off the top is that it really is a gem. It's an award-winning state park system. It has often received kudos as the best park system in the U.S., best state park system. We have over 120 parks. The first one was actually in Valley Forge in 1893. It was ultimately given over to the National Park System actually during the Bicentennial in 1976. But some of them are small, 2-3 acres, and you've got parks that are over 20,000 acres. So there's something for everyone. And my favorite sort of factoid that I've had for hanging around for years is that while Pennsylvania is the 33rd largest state in the union, only Alaska and California have more parkland than we do. So there is a lot to do here in the great outdoors.
And you have brought a Fab Five list today. First up, a place you'll be visiting in a few weeks, Cherry Springs State Park.
This one has been on my list for a while. It's in Potter County in the Northern Tier. There are black cherry trees in Cherry Springs State Park. But the main reason folks go there is because it is an international dark sky park. It is the second one in the U.S.
What's that again?
An international dark sky park. And what that means is it is a place for stargazers. So Wheelah Balms have plotted a date on the calendar in May that has no moon. The sky should be dark. They say the sky is so dark up there that the Milky Way casts a shadow. And I've seen photos of this. Really cool. So they've got, you know, the star parties that they do every year and whatnot. But the thing is, the area up there in Potter County, the northern tier, the top of the T, is so flat around this park. There's no mountains to block, you know, get in the way of the light or anything. There's just very little development up there that it is an awesome place for stargazing, and we'll soon check it out and report back.
All right. Now, you say it's easy to fall for Ricketts Glen State Park. Tell us why.
All right. If you haven't figured it out already, it's because of the falls, and falls are great and lush and flowing in the springtime. This is a moderately sized park, about 12,000, 13,000 acres. But the main falls you'll want to see there are Ganoga Falls. There are actually 22 named falls in the park. There's a lot of waterfalls in Ricketts Glen. The Falls Trail is great for hiking. Lots of old growth hemlocks. Lake Jean is popular for boaters. So this is a much loved park in Pennsylvania that folks just enjoy visiting.
And just up the road is Presque Isle State Park, which is right on the water, in this case, Lake Erie.
Lake Erie, it is our only beach, as it were, in Pennsylvania, our only real seashore. So it's popular with, you know, folks who want to, you know, take in the sun, boaters, swimmers. It's, it's one of the more visited parks in the Pennsylvania park system, but also very popular with birders. It is considered one of the premier places for bird watching in the U.S. Lots of endangered species, threatened species as well out that way that you can see. But there's an area called Gull Point where you can see a lot of migratory birds, but also lots of, you know, trails. And there's even still one of the there were four lighthouses originally in the park. One still remains, and that's a nice visual as well.
We're talking with our travel contributor, Elaine LaBalme, who tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town, talking about getting out into the great outdoors. Clear Creek State Park has a water feature as well, and in this case, the Clarion River.
Yes, the Clarion River. It's very popular with canoers, and something that I recently learned is that if you launch at Clear Creek State Park, 4.5 hours later and 10 miles later, you will be at Cook Forest State Park, which is a very popular place with Pittsburghers and a park that we've enjoyed many a time.
10 miles.
It's a nice sort of, you know, not too strenuous, easy paddle. Several hours later, you're in Cook State Park. So you can get from Clear Creek State Park down to Cook State Park just in time to pop a beer with your friends.
Oh, wow.
There you go. But so that's something that I look forward to doing this summer. You can also fish in Clear Creek, native and stocked brook trout, smallmouth bass in the Clarion River for the fishing folks. 25 trails in the park, cabins, camping. So lots of different options there. There's some bouldering there as well, too. The Bear
some
Town
what there?
Rocks. Bouldering. You can clamber up boulders. 13-year-old son loves doing that.
Does mom do that, too?
I do, but not near as well or as quickly as he does. I'm a bit more cautious on boulders, but I've done it.
Clambering up.
I did say that, clambering up boulders.
Okay, I'm just trying to, I'm learning new things from you, Elaine.
There you go.
Lastly, McConnell's Mill State Park should be in bloom this time of year.
Yep, and this park is along Slippery Rock Creek, just up the road, Newcastle area. The mountain laurels should be blooming soon, certainly by May, so it's a beautiful time of year to be there. And the old mill for which the park is named is still there. It's one of the first rolling mills in the U.S., oat and corn and wheat. So it was a very active facility. If you follow it down the road, actually, you'll get to a wonderful, very long covered bridge, one of two covered bridges in Lawrence County. And the other neat thing I like about McConnell's Mill is that part of the North Country Trail goes right through it. And this is something we've talked about in the program previously. It's part of the this National Scenic Trail that is one of the longest in the U.S. It goes from North Dakota, near your old stomping grounds, all the way to New England. So it's a very well-marked, well-developed trail, you know, decades in the making. So you can hike the North Country Trail in McConnell's Mill State Park.
Is it down by the old mill stream?
Gosh, there have to be some streams, or there's a mill. Must be, yes.
Elaine LaBalme is our travel correspondent. She tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town. Elaine, as always, great to see you. Thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you, Paul.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of the program or would like to revisit past segments, you can go to our website at WESA.FM. Until Monday, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Have a great weekend, everybody.